This is another one for you. Let's get stoned.
Mass shooting in as many weeks.
He definitely endorsed a variety of different beliefs, such as anti-Semitism and the idea that, you know, a small conspiracy of Jewish people essentially dominate world affairs. He was, you know, antagonistic to anything so-called non-white. In particular, most of rhetoric on a regular basis was directed towards blacks.
Room except for the one burning camera.
sentiment. And he was, you know, at that time he had moved to Southern California from back east. He came out to Southern California, rode out on his motorcycle with not much more than the clothes on his back, and got involved in the white power music scene immediately. That's why he relocated and became heavily involved in that music scene, playing in various different bands as a guitar player, and attending, you know, music shows and helping to promote and organize those shows, and meeting with other groups as well, and just developing a kind of a broad base set of affiliations. When I knew him, he wasn't necessarily a specific member of any one group, but he was affiliated with a large number of different groups across the white supremacy movement.
Be here with us. They will listen along with us. Perhaps you will see them. Perhaps feel them. But make no mistake, they are here. Parties will be given everywhere in the land. Our story takes place at just such a party.
Of how the white supremacism manifested itself for him. The military also a major factor in his life. How does that fit in with all this?
Page explained to me that, you know, he knew about racist skinheads and white power folks prior to joining the military. He had been involved in the punk scene in the Denver area as an adolescent. And had become aware of, you know, racist skinheads and this sort, much younger. But when he joined the military, he told me that this is what really exposed him to why, you know, the beliefs of neo-Nazism make so much sense. To put it bluntly, he told me that if you don't go into the military as a racist, you will certainly come out of the military as a racist. Harry, he told me that this is what really exposed him to why, you know, the beliefs of neo-Nazism make so much sense. To put it bluntly, he told me that if you don't go into the military as a racist, you will certainly come out of the military as a racist. And he explained that that in the military he began to realize how upside down the world is that we live in, and how discriminated whites are. You know, that there's all of this, you know, affirmative action that's essentially reverse discrimination against whites from you know, that he began to believe in this perspective. And he became exposed to white supremacist material, propaganda, while in the military, and individuals as well who already endorsed it and were involved in the white supremacy movement.
But there's no sense this necessarily leads to violence. You use the term political activism a number of times. I mean, is that what underpins it? Are they trying to change society in order to redress what they feel is some imbalance? Or, I mean, does this necessarily lead to violence?
In some cases it leads to violence, in other cases it remains, you know, essentially non-violent forms of political activism, like marches, rallies, like music shows. So this is one of the things that makes it very difficult in terms of assessing the potential threat of these types of groups and these types of individuals.
Bless it. about the killings at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Our guest is Pete Simi. He is a University of Nebraska at Omaha criminology professor, co-author with Robert Vitrell of the book American Swastika
Incident. The neo-Nazi inclinations in the 1990s, and it's important to remember that during the 1990s, this was a period after the Burmeister trial, which you mentioned, and also the bombings in Oklahoma, which were carried out by Timothy McVeigh, another veteran of the first Gulf War, who was decorated with a Bronze Star as well. So the military in the mid-90s was embarrassed by the fact that these, firstly, an active duty and a veteran had committed murder, indiscriminate murder. So they were meant to be, the narrative is that they were cracking down at this point. Now, Page's example shows that this wasn't really the case. What is certain is that during the War on Terror, even the thin regulations that did exist were completely jettisoned. I mean, I spent 2 or 3 years talking to veterans, extremist veterans, much like Page, and far-right leaders, who basically said that there was an open-door policy during the War on Terror. You could enter with swastikas tattooed on you, with SS bolts, with basically the military couldn't slow down because they had two occupations to populate and not enough soldiers.
WCOM Radio. Hey, this is Furious George. Wanted to just sign in, just quickly mention that the show is dedicated to all the folks out there fighting military industrial complexes and white supremacism and all the other craziness that's going on in the world. I'm Furious. I do this every Thursday on WCOM FM as part of the Micropower Radio Experience, where we like to take over a piece of the airwaves and spotlight some absurdity going on in the world. Pretty easy to do these days, and of course this week happens to be what's going on and the unfortunate shooting at the Sikh temple massacre. So sit back. If you're interested in what's happening with that or other issues, go to furiousg.blogspot and you can check out some of my old shows where we've taken on so many different issues over the past 15 years or so since we've been doing this. In fact, I'm going back to my old stomping grounds tomorrow. Furious George's original broadcasts came out of Asheville, North Carolina, when it was old school, totally illegal pirate radio. And then, of course, we seized a piece of the airwaves back from the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, and the FCC, and even NPR, who had been fighting low-power FM radio. So we took a piece of that, and we've been able to, over the last many years, especially here at WCOM, but also in the past in other places, just spotlighting things that maybe, you know, some people in other stations don't have the opportunity or just the cojones to talk about. So we're going to talk about white supremacism, and if you have a problem with that, you can give me a call. And I've got some punk rock friends who are going to beat your ass. No, really. Neo-Nazis, gang members, criminals, you know, in the military who are violently, you know, racist. You can just take a bite of my ass. For everyone else out there, this is potentially offensive, so turn it off right now if you have a problem with it. We're going to spotlight more of it and also throw in some crazy underground beats in the background. I'm furious!
ask you about the military's regulation of enlisted neo-Nazis and white supremacists. You write about how the Army Command Policy describes the rules for commanders to enforce. It says, quote, participation in extremist organizations and activities by Army personnel is inconsistent with the responsibilities of military service. Matt Kinnear, can you talk about the Army's regulations?
Well, the Army's regulations, and in fact the military, the whole of the military, every branch, has been ambiguous on purpose, so that at times of chronic troop needs, like the war on terror, they can basically allow these people to stay in. The regulations are basically reactive. The US military, after a tragedy like in Oak Creek or the Burmeister case, they are embarrassed by the media reaction and the public, who basically ask, why is our taxpayer money paying to arm and train these right-wing extremists? So the Army's on the back foot, then they say, oh, we've tightened the regulation. But in reality, there's nothing proactive about it. And I mean, even the regulations that are in place, which obviously are thin, were basically completely jettisoned during the war on terror. So the quote you used about right-wing extremism being inconsistent with military service, I mean, it was completely consistent with military service during the war on terror. In fact, I heard from extremist veterans themselves that their command would send them on the hardest missions, because obviously neo-Nazis and gang members as well, which was a big problem, which is worth mentioning, they're seen as more warlike.
Well,
some cases, the very same circumstances, the very same conditions, the very same characteristics result in something in terms of what happened in Wisconsin, and in other cases, it results in music shows and marches and rallies.
It has been reported that the Department of Homeland Security cut back its analysis of white extremism in the US in favor of looking at Islamic extremism, even environmental groups and so forth. Is it clear why they made that decision? Do you think then that enough attention is being given to these groups?
Well, in terms of the Department of Homeland Security, one of the things that happened, they released a report about right-wing extremism, 2009, I believe, and one of the issues they mentioned was the potential connection between involvement in the military, having experience in the military, and being involved in right-wing extremist groups, and in particular right-wing terrorism. One of the things that's very clear, if you just look at the indictments, the federal indictments of domestic terrorism that involve right-wing extremists, is disproportionately these individuals have a background in the military. They have military experience. The numbers are very clear in that respect. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that the military causes them to become a right-wing extremist or certainly not a right-wing terrorist. But there is some kind of relationship there. And when the Department of Homeland Security released that report, it was unfortunate. It became kind of a political hot potato. And the report was really heavily criticized, and I think it was unfairly characterized as suggesting somehow that all military personnel are, suspect in potential, domestic terrorists. And certainly that wasn't my read of that report. I think it is vital that these groups not be pushed to the side as being less important than other types of extremists.
Presidential contender had this to say, quote, this was a senseless act of violence and a tragedy that should never befall any house of worship. Sonny Singh, I mean, I suppose perhaps there he is going with more of this idea of senselessness. That could be quite problematic, I suppose.
I think it's absolutely problematic, and I think it's a bit of a cop-out, and sort of lets institutional and historical racism and white supremacy completely off the hook. I think there's a long-standing precedent in this country of these sorts of white acts of white supremacist terror, starting really with the founding of this country, with the settlers exterminating the indigenous population through slavery, through Jim Crow, through lynching being an American pastime. You know. Through church bombings in 1963, four black girls were killed in a church in Birmingham, Alabama. And, why aren't we talking about that? Especially with the black president, why aren't we talking about that?
I'm sure there'll be viewers there saying, hang on, these are still isolated incidents, though, aren't they? Is it too much, then, to immediately link it into some form to institutionalize racism in the United States?
I think maybe you could say that about what happened in Colorado. Since what happened in Colorado wasn't targeting a specific community, especially a specific religious or racialized community, but what happened here in Wisconsin was absolutely targeting the Sikh community, who, particularly since 9/11, has been targeted time and time again.
Austin Lithica, what do you make of the subsequent discussion we've had so far?
Well, I think the one key thing that I think is missing from this entire debate is the term terrorism. I wrote a CNN column a few days ago, calling the act of the shooting at the Sikh temple an act of domestic terrorism, because that's exactly what it was.
Isn't that what authorities have called it?
They've called it that, but we haven't heard many of our American media and socio-political leaders echo that same sentiment. And the scenario that I start out with is, imagine if a brown bearded man walked into a Wisconsin church one early Sunday morning and killed six white people. Would anybody in America even pause to call it an act of terrorism?
Has an almost cosmic sense of timing. In 2007, at the NRA's annual convention in St. Louis, he warned the crowd that today there is not one firearm owner whose freedom is secure. 2 days later, a young man opened fire on the campus of Virginia Tech, killing 32 students, staff, and teachers. Just last week, LaPierre showed up at the United Nations Conference on the Arms Trade Treaty here in New York and spoke out against what he called anti-freedom policies that disregard American citizens' right to self-defense. Now, at least 12 are dead in Aurora, Colorado, gunned down by a madman at a showing of the new Batman movie filled with make-believe violence. One of the guns the shooter used was an AK-47 type assault weapon that was banned in 1994. The National Rifle Association saw to it that the ban expired in 2004. The NRA is the best friend a killer's instinct ever had.
Bearded men and women with head coverings, and all of a sudden the terrorism discussion becomes more murky. I was getting responses to my CNN column saying, well, you know, there was no political ideology involved. Well, if white supremacy and racial holy wars are not political ideologies, then I don't know what is one.
I mean, white supremacists in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and unfortunately, as we have seen this past weekend, next to a Sikh temple.
Yeah, well, that's a good point that hasn't been raised enough. Is what does it mean? What did it mean for the occupied populations to have this army that was riven with white supremacists who saw the people they were occupying as subhuman, as well as violent gang members? I mean, gangs is also a massive problem which we don't hear about as much, because often the violence committed in the United States is inter-gang violence, so it doesn't affect the public. But I mean, there's been spates of murders between gangs involving veterans and active duty personnel. But for the populations of Iraq and Afghanistan, it was we'll never know what kind of atrocities were carried out Wisconsin style. But I'm sure they happened. I mean, there's a few clues as to what these soldiers were doing over there. One neo-Nazi veteran called Kenneth Eastridge is now serving a 10-year sentence for his part in a murder in Colorado Springs. And he was serving in Iraq with neo-Nazi SS bolts tattooed on his arm.
I want to go to a brief clip of Wade Michael Page's stepmother, Laura Page. She spoke to ABC News about how the military influenced her stepson.
I don't know if the military was good for him. I don't know. My heart's broken for the people that were killed and their families. I can't imagine what would have gone through his mind for him to do something like this.
That's Laura Page, the stepmother of Wade Michael Page. Professor Simi, I wanted to bring you back into this discussion as you listen to Matt Kennard. Tattoos, the reports from the Sikhs on the ground in Oak Creek at the temple say he was wearing a 9/11 tattoo. What about his tattoos and what were the messages in them?
Well, on his left shoulder, he has a tattoo that has the number 14. And that is a very prominent kind of code for what's called the 14 words, which was penned by a now deceased right-wing terrorist by the name of David Lane, who was active in the 1980s, was part of an underground terrorist cell called the Silent Brotherhood. Lane penned this while in prison, the 14 words, which is something to the effect of securing the existence for a future of our race and the future for white children. And this is widely, you know, used throughout the movement. People have tattoos with 14, t-shirts with 14. They'll sign emails and they're with 14. So this was one of Page's tattoos. He had a German soldier tattoo on one of his calves, and a Celtic cross, which is also a prominent symbol used by white supremacists as a tattoo, as well as in other as an insignia on other things, t-shirts and so forth. So the more recent photos that I've seen of him, he was more heavily tattooed than when I during the years that I knew him. He was, you know, starting to get tattooed, and he had several at the point that, you know, during the years that I knew him. But this is a very common thing, that as a person develops a so-called resume in the movement.
Unarmed people. And the best part is, it's perfectly legal. thanks to my friends at the NRA and ALEC, who write the laws and then feed them to politicians all over the country. If you feel threatened by a punk packing dangerous Skittles, shoot, shoot, shoot! But ALEC and I, we're not just one-shot wonders. We're funded by millions and millions of corporate dollars working to undermine things like healthcare reform. In other words, I help corporations shoot you and then deny you coverage for a pre-existing condition. It's all about getting the laws we write into state houses everywhere through our complicit lawmakers, which would sound like a crazy conspiracy if it weren't true. We write so many laws and distribute them through our member politicians, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. From blocking healthcare reform, to gutting environmental laws, to busting unions and pushing private prisons, it's a right-wing rapid-fire turkey shoot. But laws don't kill people. Laws introduced by pliable politicians backed by a shadowy organization funded by huge corporations kill people.
I said, what?
Yeah.
I said, you telling me to go funk? Funk? To go funky? I said, no. I said, yeah.
Is not in our stars, but in ourselves. In other words, people.
Actually, one thing that was very interesting was how some commentators on CNN and elsewhere were saying, oh, and they aren't even Muslims. This is why it's so particularly unfair.
Well, this is the most pernicious and dangerous kind of language. It's what I consider to be the wrong address problem, you know, where there's a suggestion that the attacks that took place in Oak Creek happened at the wrong address. If Mr. Page had gone to a mosque, this would not be a mistake, is the suggestion to my mind. And I think this is a very dangerous suggestion. By saying that Sikhs are not Muslims, are people trying to say that it's then okay to go and kill Muslims or attack Muslim houses of worship? You know, the idea that 2 billion Muslims somehow are responsible for whatever fantasy Mr. Page had, you know, put into his own head is extremely responsible. And that seemed the tenor of the media, you know, to make this kind of suggestion. Rather than, I think, the much more useful framework to understand what was happening, which is, you know, over the last 15 years, predating 9/11, there has been an intensified sense of embattlement of what Mitt Romney recently called America's Anglo-Saxon heritage. And this has come out in the anti-immigrant kind of sentiment. This came out in Arizona, in the legislation put forward by the legislature. This came out after 9/11 against Muslims and all those who seemingly were to look like terrorists. And this, of course, comes out routinely against people with black bodies. So, in my opinion, there's a broader problem here, which is the problem of America having to come to terms with the fact that by 2034, the majority population is going to be non-white.
America mourns the victims of yet another seemingly indiscriminate shooting spree. We ask how many more people have to die before the nation's politicians even consider introducing strict gun control laws.
Estimated 300 million guns in the United States. One in four adult Americans owns at least one, and most of them are men. The British newspaper The Guardian reminds us that over the last 30 years, the number of states with a law that automatically approves licenses to carry concealed weapons provided an applicant clears a criminal background check has risen from 8 to 38. Every year, there are 30,000 gun deaths and 300,000 gun-related assaults in the U.S. Firearm violence may cost our country as much as $100 billion a year. Toys are regulated with greater care and safety concerns than guns.
For tougher gun control laws. But in a country where nearly 9,000 were murdered with guns in 2010, could that be about to change? Here's what some of the witnesses of the Aurora shooting had to say.
I saw a man walk through the exit. He walked in through the exit door and was wearing all black. It looked like he had a gas mask on, a bulletproof vest, and he threw one gas, like one tear gas thing.
And then landed in the road, like right in front of us, hit the girl right in front of us. Then it exploded.
Then he threw another one.
Yeah.
He shot the ceiling, just straight up in the ceiling, and then everybody knew it was real at that point. They just started, it was any more strange chaos. You know, everybody just started to run. And that's like, went straight from here to here with a gun in my face at that point. That rifle was in my face. After that, he was shooting people behind me, and I had, like, gunshots.
I've got goosebumps. Hello, bye.
Be quiet.
I don't want to go in.
I honestly can't tell you a time frame, but it felt like forever, and it was probably like 10, 15 minutes in reality,
okay.
You know, but it was just, it was the most insane thing I've ever seen. There were little kids in there getting shot, you know, like 6-year-old kids, babies even.
President Obama appeared at a campaign stop in Florida, but told the crowd he wanted to forego politics.
That sound came from inside the house.
I thought it came from across the open field.
Create Batman.
With this, it's a way of showing that commitment, so that you tend to get more and more tattoos the longer you're involved in these types of groups, to the point where, you know, some individuals are actually what's called sleeved, which is they have tattoos all the way down to their wrists, and in some little bit more unusual cases, people will get tattoos all over their faces, all over their heads, as a way to show how committed they are to the white supremacy movement.
The man you're talking about who wrote the neo-Nazi, who wrote the 14 words, David Lane, together with Bruce Pierce, were convicted of their involvement with the killing of the Jewish talk show host Alan Berg.
Correct. You know, that's a good example of the type of terrorism that has occurred among the white supremacy movement. And all too often when we think about terrorism, we don't necessarily associate it with right-wing extremists, especially since 9/11. Unfortunately, terrorism has almost become synonymous with violent radical jihadis, and too often people ignore the incidents of terrorism that have occurred at the hands of white supremacists.
So intrinsic, its toxic eruptions no longer shock, except momentarily when we hear of a mass shooting like this latest in Colorado. But this too will pass, and the nation of the short attention span will quickly find the next thing to divert us from the hard realities of America in 2012.
And the politicians have been unable, in a sense, to speak sensibly about this transition. Instead, they stoke the flames of anxiety and provide political and, in a sense, violent space for people like Mr. Page.
Well, we do have those statistics from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who say that the radical right has been growing for a decade and did again in 2011. The SPLC intelligence report found that the number of hate groups was up to 1,018 last year. That number has nearly doubled since 2000. The center attributes this rise to economic fears, the proliferation of conspiracy theories, and changing racial demographics in America, as Vijay Prashad was suggesting there. But the SPLC says the election of Barack Obama, the first black president, has had the biggest influence. The Patriot Movement, a radical anti-government militia, has seen a 755% increase in just the last 3 years, from 149 groups in 2008 to more than 1,200 groups in 2011. Of course, there's another way of looking at this, Sonny, saying, isn't this proliferation of groups because the tide is turning against them? Demographics are changing. Societal attitudes are changing. This is more of a sign of their marginalization and desperation, perhaps.
Perhaps it is. And, you know, it's also an interesting fact that since 9/11, there's been more attempted terrorist acts by white supremacists or white power groups than there have by supposed Islamist groups or groups linked to Al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, we have government policy that's vilified this entire community of 2 billion Muslims, as Vijay said. And we're not talking about that. We focus on Muslims, Muslims, Muslims. Muslim and terrorist have become practically synonymous in this day and age. Yet we're kind of, I think, in the discussion that's happening right now, we've often left our own government off the hook. If our government's making policies that considers Muslims suspects, essentially, if the NYPD is spying on mosques all over the tri-state area, then why are these sorts of attitudes not going to be in the mainstream? So I think the danger in talking about these white supremacist groups, I do think we do need to talk about them and investigate them, but I think the danger is to consider that as something that's really fringe or just on the margins of society, where I think the reality is racism and white supremacy are very much in the mainstream of American society and have been for hundreds of years.
Is that, again, necessarily a bad thing, Arsalan and Iftikhar? Isn't there an honesty about that when you have a quote?
It is later than you think.
No, I think what it does is it empowers those people who believe that they're at the fringe. If they're starting to hear sound bites that sound a whole lot like their talking points on Fox News and, you know, right-wing talk media, they might feel more empowered to actually manifest their hatred into violence and acts. And you know, I always bring it back to the discussion on terrorism. You know, the more and more, if our American thought, political, and media leaders called this an act of terrorism, I think that would send more of a resounding message to these people on the fringe that if you do something like this, if you even think of a harebrained copycat anywhere in the country, you will be a terrorist. You will not be a jingoistic patriot, you know, white uber nationalist. You will be a terrorist. You will be one of the quote unquote bad guys. You know. When a person goes and, you know, what Wade Page was doing was not just killing 6 people in the Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. He was sending a message to all brown people in America, to people in Muslim mosques and Hindu temples and Sikh Gurdwaras around the country, that people like him are still going to try to, quote unquote, take back America. So this absolutely had a political ideology to it. And unless we call a spade, another example that I always give is, imagine a brown man would almost assassinate a member of Congress and kill 6 people in a grocery store parking lot in Arizona, would that not be called an act of terrorism? But because his name was Jared Lee Loeffner, you know, we just think, oh, that's just another kooky, insane white guy. Within our meta-narratives that really, really are problematic and I think empower people like Wade Page.
Professor Prashad, to go back to this idea then of soul-searching that President Obama mentioned, I think he probably was more referring to the issue of gun control, which actually he's quite reluctant to really address, it would seem, let alone then this issue of connecting what appear to be sporadic actions of extreme violence with a wider context of casual racism, institutional racism, you know, the mainstream discourse of race. I mean, that's definitely not going to be soul-searched, is it?
Well, you know, in my opinion, if I was to advise him, I would suggest 4 different things that need to happen. The first is, I think, yes, despite his reluctance to take on the gun lobby, I think it's fundamental as part of the discussion. You know, the fact is that there are too many of these kind of acts of violence with this kind of arsenal, and we need to have a much more mature conversation about weaponry. That's the first thing. The second thing, we need to have a very serious discussion about questions of mental health and the fact that at the same time as these kind of acts happen, we're cutting back on mental health care as far as the government is concerned, and particularly mental health care for veterans. So that's the second thing, the second main discussion that needs to happen. I think the third incident that we should consider is the question of dignity. I mean, one of the reasons why extremism or white supremacist groups are rising is people on the margins of society, on the social margins, are feeling as if they are without dignity. And in a sense, they are right. The kind of policies, economic policies, social policies pursued by the government that give, in a sense, the entire basket of goods to the 1% of the population creates a situation where very large numbers of people feel marginalized. And I would say that's the third thing we need to soul search about. And finally, I'm very much with Arsalan and Sunny here in believing strongly that it's not a question of the extremist groups themselves. You know, it creates a situation of great sanctimoniousness when the elite can sit back and say, well, it's some working class white guy who did this. But the fact of the matter is that the politicians themselves open the door wide to very hateful kinds of thinking. Just recently, Mitt Romney in England made a very silly statement. He said the United Kingdom and the United States are related by their Anglo-Saxon heritage. Well, that would be news to people of Mexican descent who make up a very large part of the American population and whose lands were taken away during the wars of the 1840s and 50s. So these kind of casual comments, I think, are very dangerous.
Shoot 'em up, Charlie here. By now, you know that I get to help vigilante types kill unarmed people.
Yo, this is Furious George signing off here. Stick around. We got Bodacious in this coming up soon. I will be checking you guys out next Thursday on the Furious George Experience at 10 o'clock. And if you want to see some old school shows, go to furiousg.blogspot.com. I'll talk to y'all soon. I'm Furious.